Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 120th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is starting where people start. I'm joined by Victoria Grady, who, along with Patrick McCreesh, is a co-author of Stuck, How to Win at Work by Understanding Loss. The publisher is Routledge. Victoria is the academic director of the MSM graduate program and associate professor of management organizational behavior in the School of Business at George Mason University. She's also the professor in residence for Forvis. Besides her consulting practice and previous books, Victoria has also had her writings appear in publications such as the Harvard Business Review and the Journal of Change Management. Welcome to the show, Victoria.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm thrilled to be here today.
Good. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So if you don't mind, give us a brief overview of what the book's about.
So the book is actually a continuation of some original research that I did back earlier in 2015, 2016. And Patrick and I published what I would consider to be a more academic textbook publication. And unfortunately, about 7 people read it. So we
sure
we recognized that it needed to be a bit more user-friendly, as I'm quoting in the air quotes. And we worked on Stuck together. Patrick and I worked really hard to create a book that was a more user-friendly, practice-oriented type of discussion around the human behavior of change, right? And when I say human behavior of change, I mean the individuals that are collectively the organization, obviously, are humans, right? And we all have a very unique perspective and how we engage and interact with change and transformation in our organization. So we wanted to create something that was easy to understand, easy to follow, and quite frankly, easy to put into practice in your organization.
Sure. Well, I have to tell you that I was struck by the fact the book does a lot with attachment theory, because I have a PhD in English, and probably the lead into my creating a company that was in the psychology space essentially was I was working for a company and doing the PR work and often going to South Carolina, and didn't have a book to read on the flight down. So back in those days, they still had magazines, and I think it was Business Week, maybe Newsweek. Anyway, they had a special article, long article, about attachment theory, and I read it with absolute fascination. So in your case, you have a diagram. It's on page 61, and you have a high avoidant and low avoidant and low and high anxiety and these 4 quadrants. Seems to me a rather central chart to the book. Can you walk us through a bit, and probably for listeners, give them some sense of what attachment theory is all about?
Yes, Dan, I think that is so interesting. And I would be super curious if you remembered what year even that article appeared in Business Week, because I had a similar experience with a book by a gentleman named Jerry Harvey called The Abilene Paradox, which is more organizational behavior related. But he mentioned attachment theory in that book, and it set me off down a path that ultimately became the work that I've done now for 20 years. And so attachment theory, in a nutshell, is a biological and instinctual response that all humans have that is solidified or kind of is put in place very young in our lives. So somewhere between 0 and 8 months, the literature tells us, we form an attachment, and again, air quotes, to an object that is familiar and comfortable to us to help transition through times of uncertainty. And so at that age, your transition, most children activate that attachment response when they are first trying to let themselves fall asleep in a safe space, right? And so it would be something to do with generally your going to bed routine. It might be a blanket or an animal or a mobile that plays above your bed, but some object that helps you feel secure as you transition to, being an infant and falling asleep. And then throughout life, we do this repeatedly, not necessarily with a blanket or a teddy bear, although some might use a blanket or a teddy bear, but we do it with different objects. And as we get to the workplace, a lot of us use our leaders or our technology or our office space, or the ability to work remote now. I mean, the COVID changed everything. The pandemic did in terms of what we rely on for support. But basically, attachment theory is it helps you understand why we need those support mechanisms as we transition through change. So that's kind of a super quick overview. Does that help?
It does. I'm going to take it a bit further, but to answer your own question, I think it was probably actually Newsweek, and it was the spring of 1998, so quite a while ago at this point. But I do remember fetching it out of the cubby hole up front in the airplane and just loving the article. I thought it was so revelatory. And if we take it to a work situation, whereas attachment theory might often involve the parents, maybe even stereotypically the mom, in the workplace, the boss becomes so often that primary relationship, which determines whether we're actually going to be satisfied and have fulfillment at work or end up fleeing the place. Since a lot of the research, including the work done by Gallup, would indicate that relationship really kind of overshadows anything else that happens in the workplace. Is that your own experience, or you got some additional wrinkles to that?
I think that that's a very interesting reference. I do think the leader is extremely important, but a lot of times we have found, especially in our work, as I live in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, so we've done a significant amount of work with federal organizations. And federal organizations, a lot of times the top leader is a political appointee. And so that person comes and goes. And so it would be particularly challenging if a strong attachment was a consistent mechanism for support, because those leaders are going to come and go. There's no way around it. That's just the nature of federal agencies and political appointees being oftentimes at the top. So what we've seen is that there are different types of support objects other than the leader that can be just as effective and as consistent. And it could be a colleague or a coworker. We've seen teamwork emerge many times as a substitute for a strong relationship with a leader. And I think that is fantastic, quite frankly, and very collaborative in nature. And we saw some of that really get strained as people were sent home in response to the pandemic, because the proximity to their teams was now geographically dispersed. And that was very challenging for a lot of folks who were used to having that support of the teams just right there available to them at any time. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, no, I think we are, we underestimate how much we depend on these visceral sensory signals and attachments and experiences together. We like to think we've evolved way past that, but I don't think that's remotely the case. Going back to the diagram on page 61, so you have these four groups: the anonymous, the insecure, the stable, and distracted. And then you also have something else in the book that got my attention, because I'm a big fan of the Big Five model, five-factor model for personality traits. But I noticed that because you were kind of mapping the stable, autonomous, distracted, and insecure onto those five personality traits. Maybe you want to say more about that. But I also noticed that openness, interestingly, did not get mapped onto any one of those four kind of parameters, insecure, autonomous, et cetera. Just that's the nature of openness. It's not going to do that. I just was curious.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to your first question first. And let's the diagram on page 61. So those are attachment styles. And it's interesting, Dan, because that has really been an evolving segment of our research literally in the last year. And so a lot of what we have found in the last year is not reflected in the book. And the interesting piece is understanding more about how individuals in organizations have specific attachment styles and what role those attachment styles might play on your ability to be a good leader, right? Because a lot of these are perspectives similar to personality that are grounded in really based on your environmental interaction and experience as a child, and how that impacts your, your continuous evolution as a member of an organization and potentially a leader in an organization. I mean, it's really fascinating. And a lot of the work initially was hypothesis driven around the big five. And so I will share that I think that we have are evolving and are in process of collecting some data in that space that is going to give us more information about how it might map more succinctly. We have a really good sample population of individuals that we are working with. And so I think that is my response to that last part of your question is, let's just stay tuned, because I think it's evolving. as a researcher, I'm gonna say stay tuned, and it's coming down the pipeline, and it'll probably be out there in the next three months or so, but I'm gonna hesitate to comment further than that.
Okay, well, I'll take you to one other model before I let this go. So I happen to be from St. Paul and the land of Charles Schulz. In fact, a hockey arena he dedicated is probably three blocks from my house. So you also have one other table, and I don't normally get table obsessed in my interviews, but this one got my attention because you took the Peanuts characters and you put them across these models. So maybe you've evolved way past that. But my question would have been, whatever happened to Snoopy? Because he wasn't given one of these four dimensions. Anything you can share with us? I imagine your research does not involve the Snoopy characters, but the Peanut characters. But I don't know, anything you want to say there? I'm being a little bit frivolous, perhaps, but not necessarily.
No, I don't think so. It's funny that you bring that up, because Linus was the initial connection for me personally. When I read about this in Dr. Harvey's book, I said, I'm not sure I buy it. And then I came across a picture of a month or so later, randomly, of Linus in his blanket. And I was struck by that image, so much so that I even initially communicated with the with the folks who own all the Charles Schulz intellectual property to see if they would let me use Linus. They said sure, but it's going to be really expensive. And I was like, no, I'm an academic. That's probably not
going to work.
No, it's not going to work. But I will definitely use that when I'm explaining to people. And that's very relatable. Is Linus. So the original image in my brain of how this works was Linus. We use the Peanuts characters because that is where I always start my discussion, especially with folks who are a bit dismissive of acknowledging that a developmental psychology theory could have application to adults in the workplace. And so when you initially introduce that, sometimes it's met with skepticism. And so to interject the Linus example, oftentimes, okay, now I'm with you. As far as Snoopy goes, that is a great question, Dan. I'm not sure. Here's what I'll tell you. I think Snoopy would fit in the middle. And one of the things that we've found, and we've really been digging in around our attachment styles research, is 58% approximately of individuals in the world. I'm using quotes in the air, individuals in general, type out in the secure quadrant. But what we found is that not all secure is the same, right? And we have identified, literally, this is hot off the press, three different clusters, if you will, in the secure quadrant in the last few months. And I really think Snoopy would be an individual that would fit towards the middle of that quadrant. And that seems to be a really, really fantastic place for leaders who embrace change, not only for themselves, but who are able to really drive it forward with an incredible level of support for their employees. And so it's really that space where if the leaders in that little niche, they seem to be able to consistently have successful change and transformation. I'm not able to, give you data at this moment, but we should be able to have some pretty hardcore information out in the next few months. And Dan, I'll give you a teaser that I'll come back and tell you more about that.
Let's stay with the idea of these leaders who are successful. I mean, what, to the extent that you can offer anything at this point, I mean, it seems to me a lot of leaders are urging other people to change, but aren't necessarily changing themselves. So those who are able to do both parts of that and then be internally consistent, is there a profile that fits? Is it more women than male leaders? Is it a certain personality trait that seems to help them with this? I would think of openness to experience being the natural fit, but take me where you might with that question.
I will. And I think that openness to experience is one way to describe it. But I think interest or experience with developing relationships. So openness to connection, but it's really not just openness, right? I mean, it's really about individuals who are aware and connected with how they feel, but also willing to put themselves out there and take the time. I mean, we see leaders all the time who are like, I don't have time for this. Come on, chop, chop, chop. We got to move forward. That's not what your people often need you to do, right? They need you to say, okay, this is expensive. This might be time consuming, but I hear you folks that relationships are an important, and connectivity is a really critical and important part of you understanding why this change is coming down the pipeline, how this change is going to impact your day-to-day work task, how this change could impact your personal life in addition to your work, and how that work-life balance is a very important part to who this organization and its culture is. I mean, it's all those things that are oftentimes the things that leaders designate out to others. And what we're seeing is that employees really want it to come, from the top, from the individuals that really have the ability to represent that organization. Does that make sense, Dan?
Oh no, I like that answer a lot for a couple of reasons. One is I just recently read a piece in the Harvard Business Review. It was a survey of executives and how they spend their time. And I would love to have said that they spent their time kind of like Jack Welch did, which was more than 50% of it on personnel issues and interacting with pretty sizable groups of people and understanding where they were coming from and what their issues were and how they felt and so forth. Instead, the article revealed that more of their time was spent entirely alone or with very small cadres of people they already were very familiar with. So there wasn't the kind of outreach I would have expected or hoped, because I agree with you. I think that's what a good leader who's going to make those changes needs. They've got to get past their own comfort level And it strikes me they often don't.
Mm-hmm. And there's sometimes jobs. So I'll give you an example. We did a little bit of work with a federal agency, and I'll just leave it at that. And that particular federal agency had a cluster of individuals that all had very similar personality types, and they were also very similar attachment styles. And what we recognized is that for that work, employment category, for that group of individuals, having that similar personality type and the similar attachment perspective was very important because they had to make really, really critical decisions very quickly, right? And you and I would, members of society at large, are happy, quite frankly, that we have individuals that can make decisions like that, you know, on very, very quickly and decisively. But what we saw is that the leader for that organization was actually not like that. The leader was that bridge between those individuals and the bigger agency. And it was that incredible bridge that I think made that organization that was so siloed in terms of the, you know, all people being so similar. That's what made them able to exist in that space. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. I guess I'd come back to something. I'm going to stay with my comfort level concern. Co-authored kind of group created a book called Blah, 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 Snarky Guide to Office Lingo. And the definition I used for diversity was in senior management, a short white guy. Because I got to tell you, as I go through LinkedIn and I see who's the executive team, company after company, we have moved so little in terms of incorporating diversity. I'll start with gender, but it goes past that. And so it seems to me that the rank and file looking at the executives, exhorting them to change, could easily just say, wait a second, how much have you changed? How much are you open to change? Because in your book, you have some statistics that would seem to indicate that we have at least two really big issues in the workplace. One is around, you know, the culture of the company, which seems to be more the purview of the executives to try to help handle. And most companies find that their culture isn't all it could be. And another big one is employee engagement, which is pretty low. And that one seems to be more the purview of the manager. So that seems to be the dichotomy a bit, with motivation falling to the manager. I want to make sure before we get out of the interview that you have a chance to speak about those two levels and their charges to make things work.
Mm-hmm. And those two levels being engagement and culture?
Yeah, and executives and managers, mm-hmm. respectively, in that. Does that comport with what's in the book, or am I mistaken?
No, I absolutely think so. There's just, you know, it's interesting because I am definitely an academic at the core. So when people start talking about different things like you just did, my brain just starts spinning with ideas and thoughts. And, you know, I think that what you're describing is an incredibly important part of kind of where we've landed, and making sure that I'll tell you one thing, and this is what was going through my brain that we found a couple of years ago, is that engaged people are super interesting. And oftentimes, as you would probably expect, your highest performers are extremely engaged. But one really interesting nuance that we found that we think is an important lesson for both managers and executive level leadership is that a lot of times our most engaged employees, who are our high performers, are also running themselves into the ground. Right. And I think that observation and that research actually came out of the Emotional Intelligence Laboratory at Yale. And it was game changing for me personally to consider. And I think that as I've considered that in the role that, you know, attachment styles and attachment behavior play in that bigger picture, I think that is a super important message for executives to consider how all these different pieces fit together. And for those organizational leaders who aren't willing to take the time to really understand the individuals that are both your high performers and everybody else, right, inside the organization, it is to say that that particular organization, I believe, will struggle with change, period. I do not believe that it is going to be an easy road if you don't take the individual behavioral response from your collective organization as a critical factor in who the organization is and how it functions. And you can't do that if you're isolated and you're not really out there interacting with your people. Does that make sense, Dan?
Yeah, and you have to show respect for emotions. Another definition that someone offered who's an HR specialist was that HR was defined as seen by, unfortunately, some maybe machismo male leaders as, quote unquote, the Kleenex lady, that it was all about tears and it was, you know, poo-pooed. But in fact, of course, emotions are very important, as both of us in this conversation realize. So I want to thank you, Victoria, so much for your time and for being my guest here on Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode 120, Starting Where People Start. Victoria Grady is, along with her co-author, Patrick McCreesh, the author of Stuck, How to Win at Work by Understanding Loss. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I took one from Winston Churchill, who said, "To improve is to change. To be perfect is to change often." Until next time, take care and be well.